Hi everyone, and welcome to the special Meet the Board series featured once a month on Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast. Each week on Wednesdays, Managed Healthcare Executive features C-Suite healthcare professionals whom we speak with about the most important issues in healthcare. In our Meet the Board series, we spotlight a member of MHE's editorial advisory board so our listeners know more about our board members and their roles in healthcare. The Meet the Board series is broadcasted at the end of every month. So be sure when you tune in to listen in and learn a lot. Hi there, I'm Brianna Contreras, Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive, and this week MHE is featuring Editorial Advisory Board member Lily Brillstein for a new episode of our Meet the Board series on Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast. Lily is CEO of Be Collaborative, which works with stakeholders across the healthcare continuum to successfully make the move from fee-for-service to value-based healthcare. In this episode, we get to learn a bit more about Lily and hear her thoughts on the advancements of episodes of care, as well as the challenges of transitioning from fee-for-service to value-based care during COVID-19. Hello, everyone. My name is Brianna Contreras. I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
And hello, everybody. My name is Peter Werwein, and I am Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Today, we are speaking with Lily Brillstein. She is CEO of Be Collaborative. Lily is also a member of MHE's Editorial Advisory Board, and today she'll be featured on our Meet the Board series, where our listeners and readers of MHE will get a chance to know more about Lily. So Lily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. So first, just to get started, if you can just share with our listeners, you know, kind of what it is that you do, and you know how you got where you are today in this line of healthcare.
Oh, I'd be happy to, and really thank you for inviting me today. It's sort of a funny non-linear route I think I took to get to where I am today. My background is in public health, and so I often say there's not anybody more surprised than I am that I spent 20 some odd years on the payer side. That was not where I intended to do my work. But I had a great time on the when I was working for payers. And really for most of my career, I spent my time organizing and choreographing a dance, if you will, between the business side of the house and the clinical side of the house, so that contracts weren't being written as they typically are in fee-for-service with business folks without the information from the clinical folks and clinical teams working with those contracted partners without really having any information about what's in the contract. And so I did a lot of that kind of work and then what was called disease management in earlier days. And then the most recent work that I did before I left the payer side and started Be Collaborative was during the time I worked for Horizon, which is the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan in New Jersey. I built their episodes of care program there. So that's the value-based care models program that focuses really on specialty care. When I got there in 2013, Horizon was coming out of a small pilot with hip and knee replacements. And the mandate to me was scale this. We've seen enough success in terms of the triple aim. We'd like to see now if we can scale this across other specialties. And so my goal was really to build a portfolio that was broad in terms of reaching lots of different specialties and deep, going down into a specialty. So for example, orthopedics, and not just looking at hip and knee replacements, but looking at back surgeries and other things. And then also to consider how to create value around chronic conditions. How do we build models for that? And also how do we build in behavioral health into physical medicine models, and how do we build in non-traditionally covered services like transportation or mindfulness or doulas into these models. And so over the course of the 7 or so years that I was there, that's the kind of work that that we did. And we built a very robust program that had at its core the triple aim, but had this really wonderful bonus attached to it, which was the way we did business was so completely different from the way business has historically been done in managed care, where a plan designs a model that it thinks is very good, and then, you know, kind of forces it on the providers, and it, you know, it doesn't have the sort of considerations the provider might need, and it typically doesn't work. So because of the way that we worked, which was very collaborative and very inclusive, the bonus we got was that it really changed the spirit of the relationship between the payer and the providers. And the providers came to see us, the payer, as their trusted advisors and colleagues. And, you know, it's just, it was just wonderful. It did my public health heart good on so many levels. And so in the course of one of the ways I built that program was I was, you know, out and about all the time talking to people, meeting people, listening to people, sharing stories around the challenges I was facing, the successes I was having, really in an effort to help share information, but also bring back the best pieces of information to my own program, which is what I did. And so the program became very well known. I started a group among the Blues where we would share information on a regular basis. I got to do work with CMS. I got to do some writing with you all, and quite a lot of speaking. And so, you know, my mission as and my public heart, my public health heart, and my mission really is to continue to progress this movement across the country, the move from fee-for-service to fee-for-value. And I thought, you know, that we don't have a movement if we don't bring the payers in. And I realized, you know, that I had a sort of interesting credibility among the payers because I am one of them. And I built this program on the inside, you know, of a payer. And so if I could come, you know, start this company, be collaborative, and stay connected with my payer friends and help them understand, you know, from my experience, what worked the best, what worked the least, and understand, you know, kind of what their priorities are, where they're focusing, and share what I'm learning out in, you know, in the world from providers, you know, what are they saying? Because they have all sorts of fears and concerns. And there are all sorts of these wonderful, innovative startups who have developed tools that could create success in value-based care. And so, so in with Be Collaborative, what I do typically is I do a lot of work with payers, although I don't generally take them as clients. Sometimes I do if they want me to help them build their program, but generally I stay, you know, we're colleagues. And my clients tend to be provider groups, pharma actually, and lots of these innovative startups. And the work that I do is to really help them understand, how to express the value that they bring in a way that can be understood by a payer. You know, having been on the payer side for so long and having people present to me every single day about how they're going to solve my problems and half the time having no idea what they were talking about, you know, it's really important to be able to express that value so that a payer A doesn't have to work too hard to understand it, and B that you work towards building models that are clinically meaningful, but that actually can be administered by a payer or with a payer. And you know, that last concept is very important and is not often contemplated or understood by, you know, other stakeholders. So much of the work I do is around sort of extracting what's the value, how do we say it, and then, you know, what are the supporting materials? And then because I talk to the payers all the time, you know, I'll understand, you know, what are their focus, what's their priority, and where might there be a nice connection? Where if I'm, you know, out in the world and I, you know, come across groups that might be a perfect fit for the particular situation that this payer is looking for, you know, nothing is more fun than sort of putting them together and creating a new partnership.
Peter here. Lily, just a couple of questions. I think you're pretty careful in using the term episodes of care. Other people use the term bundle payments. And, you know, obviously there are synonyms in the world, but why do you use the term episodes of care?
You know, that it's such an appropriate question for me. And I will say there are people who I know around the country, when they are talking and they'll say bundled payments, they'll suddenly look at me and say, oh, I'm really sorry. So nobody has to apologize to me for it, but you're absolutely right. I don't use it. I don't use the term bundled payments very often. And there are really two reasons. The most important from my perspective is that these models are about improving quality and member experience, and ultimately reducing the overall cost of care. But if you use the term bundled payment, the only thing you hear is the money. You don't hear anything about patient care and outcomes. And I think we've just had so much of that in fee-for-service, where all we focus on is the money, the unit cost, the unit of care. The second reason, honestly, is also because in most cases, when somebody's talking about a true bundled payment, they're talking about a risk-based model, a prospective payment, where a bundle of money is paid up front. And most of the models in the country today are not prospective. There are some, but there are not many, and I am a huge advocate of not starting in that space, but starting with retrospective models that don't shift risk too early. I do believe if you shift the risk too early, and I've said this lots of times, it is sort of akin to getting into an airplane with a pilot who hasn't first been in a simulator. And if that pilot crashes the plane, you could die and people could get hurt. And I think if you shift risk before your partners understand what the data shows, how to look at it, how to reorganize, how to communicate and collaborate, people could get hurt, And so and truthfully, payers are at no greater risk in a retrospective upside only model than they are in fee for service. It's just make any sense to say that providers will start performing more poorly simply because you give them an opportunity to earn more money. That just, doesn't happen. But thank you for asking me that question, because that is important for me.
The other question I wanted to ask that occurred to me as you were speaking was that you say that it's very important that providers and other entities who come to payers with a program, that it has to be something that the payer can administer. And I was wondering whether you could just unpack that a little bit. And what are the elements of a program? What has to be there for the payer to, the light to go off in the payer's head to say, oh, we can do this, we can administer this?
Yeah, so let me first clarify that just like I don't think payers, that it makes sense for payers to come to providers and other partners with a fully baked program, so too, I don't believe others should come to payers and other stakeholders with a completely fully baked program. I do think it's important to have a program, a model, and understand what the payer is looking for and how they're organized, so that you can figure out if your program fits in. But I always sort of counsel my clients, as well as payers, if I'm working with them, to be open to the perspectives of others. Don't be too married to your program, like the nth degree of your program when you go in. Be willing to listen and hear that there might be something that might make it better than you even could have thought of. So to your question, in terms of, what I think it has to have for the light bulb to go off for payers to administer, I feel like there's two questions there, Peter. One is, what is it that needs to be there for the light bulb to go off for the payer to be interested first, right? And second, what needs to be there for the payer to be able to administer it? For the first question, I think in terms of what the payers really want to see, that one of their primary goals is to create predictability of cost, right? They're managing their membership, You want to make sure they have good, consistent outcomes, and then they need to really manage the predictability of cost, which is why there's this initial attempt to shift the risk immediately, right? I think to the extent that the value proposition can describe for the payer what the issue is, and what is the issue as it relates to the payer, which is typically, what does it mean in terms of longer term care, longer term costs of care? What is the return and how quickly does that happen so that they can figure out actuarially whether it makes sense? And then I think to the administration question, I think it's a different question. I think, we've all heard sort of the jokes about, you know, everybody's not a payer thinking that, you know, there are rooms at payers that have phones in them that just ring and nobody ever answers them. And that payers just say no because they feel like saying no. And the truth is payers often say no because either they don't really understand what you're asking them or what you're asking of them can't be done on their systems. And so as we move, you know, from fee-for-service into value-based care, we have to be really aware and thoughtful of the fact that the payer systems are all sitting on a fee-for-service chassis. So they can't yet pay easily based on outcomes. They're still focused, they can focus on outcomes, but the systems are focused on paying in increments. And so, you know, when I say it has to be administrable, I mean things like that, being thoughtful of where is the payer today, just like the payers need to be thoughtful of where are the providers today. They're not ready to take risk, or they, you know, they have or haven't been in a model. They do or they don't understand, you know, the data. You have to be thoughtful about what the payer actually has to work with today so that you can get started. And, you know, this, I always talk about the move from fee-for-service to fee-for-value as a movement, and I see it as a movement. And I think we will see movement, you know, slow steps, because the payers are big, you know, they're like big giant dinosaurs. It takes a lot to, you know, make a move there. But if you're able to speak a language that means something to them, and for me, that means always connecting the dots really well. So, you know, you don't just say, you know, we have a problem in this country. There are, you know, there's too many C-sections, or there are, you know, there's too much variation in care among people living with, coronary artery disease. You need to say at the end, so there are X number of people in, you know, your population that likely have, you know, CAD, and the cost of care is X, you know, it's due to, you know, excessive visits to the ER or inappropriate management of medications, whatever the levers are and whatever the disease state is. And you need to connect those dots so that the payer can actually follow, you know, your train of thought, because I'm telling you, you know, if you're presenting to a payer, you're not the first one that day, and you're not, you know, you're probably not the fifth one that week. So make it easy for them, and don't send, you know, 25 pages, send one page so that they can at least understand what you're saying, and be mindful of what they have to work with. So that's really what I meant.
Sounds like it's a combination of doing your homework and then boiling it down, not in a dumb way, but boiling it down to maybe three or four essential points.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
Yeah.
So Lily, I actually want to ask, I think, more of the obvious question. So first I wanted to ask you, I guess, how did COVID, you know, affect Be Collaborative in your practice? And then how did COVID in your eyes affect the transition, or this current transition of fee-for-service and value-based care?
So another awesomely great question. I think COVID has had a very significant impact on both. So I used to travel excessively, you know, or extensively and excessively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my last flight was March 5th of 2020, just to give you an idea. And it was my 18th flight of the year. And it was only March 5th. Right. When I heard that we were going to be home for maybe 2 weeks, I gasped. And I thought, home for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so now here we are, you know, 15 months or so later. And I was able to move all of my business to a virtual platform and feel incredibly grateful for that. I have lots of clients who, like you, I have not ever met except like we are meeting right now on my iPad. And it's pretty extraordinary. And I think have really come to realize, as have many, you know, of the people that I work with, that we don't necessarily have to be in the same room and be able to, you know, physically see each other to get a lot of work accomplished. And I think that we are seeing in as a direct result of COVID, the same sort of impact in healthcare. The fact that we can collaborate really effectively around the world without actually having to be physically in the same room. And that in fact, in some cases, it's more effective. There are less logistics to figure out. And so I think COVID in many ways has accelerated the use of telemedicine and some other sort of digital tools that for many, many years were kind of simmering on the back burner, but have now reached, you know, their boiling point and are being used. And so I think one of the really good things that's come out of this whole experience is an ability to create virtual collaboration, which means you don't have to collaborate just with the doc or the partner who's in your neighborhood. You can find the very best you know, group, individual partners, and collaborate that way. And you can create seamless virtual visits, you know, for individuals who need care in a way that we can't really do so easily in person. So I think it's had a tremendous impact, actually.
For sure. Thank you.
Lily, one thing I wanted to ask you about, which is that, as you know, CMS and CMMI have launched, you know, a flotilla of various value-based programs. And there's a new administration, of course. And I'm just wondering how you see things changing in this area of value-based care. Several people have said to me that they think that there might be a need for pruning of programs, that a lot of stuff got sort of tried. Some of it worked, some of it didn't, but it now is it sort of a time of reckoning and maybe settling in on not quite so many models. I'm curious, I guess there's two questions in that long-winded statement. One, do you think that we're going to see a paring down of models? And two, what sort of changes do you expect to see the Biden administration and CMS bring about?
So I think you're right. There are a zillion models. And I think maybe not a zillion, but there are a lot of models. And I think there have been success in a number of them. And I think one of the greatest successes is that a lot of the commercial plans started to take notice and started to implement some plans of their own, models of their own. To me, that in and of itself is a success. I have lots of, you know, conversations with Chris Ritter at CMS around the BPCIA program and some of the other specialty care programs. My understanding at the moment is, you know, so many things are on hold as the new administration sort of figures out, you know, what will be next. I think we will see a lot of changes. My guess is we will start to see at not only through the government, but also in the private payers, a lot more focus on condition-based models, you know, chronic conditions. I know there's lots of people who think of me as sort of the, you know, the bundled payment queen or the episode queen, but my own thinking, you know, has started to evolve. And I think that while I do think we can make an episode out of anything, if you have the, you know, the right, you just need criteria and discipline. I don't necessarily think those are the right models for managing individuals who are living with chronic conditions with multiple comorbidities that aren't simply one like a hip replacement, you know, they go on lifetime. And so I like the model that I call it sort of a hybrid model. It's a specialty care medical home. And I think of it as a hybrid because of a patient-centered medical home, which is a primary care attributed model. You're looking at a heterogeneous population, and the goal is to keep everybody healthy. So, you know, they'll make sure you get your flu shots and your blood pressure and mammograms and colonoscopies. And when we go to episodes of care, which is in specialty, now you're looking at, you know, a very precise population, clinically similar individuals who actually have something already. They're either having a procedure or they have a diagnosis or a healthcare event. And the goal is to reduce the variations in care and cost of care to be able to optimize both of those. The specialty care medical home model to me is a little bit of a hybrid because you're going to have a population of people attached. There'll be a lead doc who acts like the primary point of contact, but it won't be a PCP. It will be a specialist who's responsible for the sort of principal diagnosis, but will bring in all of the other and coordinate the care among all of the other care partners in the platform. And it is set up to be like a PCMH, to it doesn't end after a certain period of time. We need to establish some sort of arbitrary points of measurement so that we can actually measure the success. So maybe every 6 months or every year or so. But it's like a medical home model because it will go on typically for a lifetime for the patient, and will only be broken without any seams to the patient, but it'll be broken to look at measurements, be able to see if those variations in care and cost of care among this clinically similar population have in fact been optimized.
And are these specialty care medical homes, is this something that you are working on with commercial payers, or do these already, forgive me, I'm aware of it notionally, but I'm not sure whether I know, I don't know whether it exists in sort of actuality.
Yeah, so there are some around the country. You know, it's, again, I think that's in its nascent stages. And, but the answer is yes, I am working with, I have some like really interesting projects that I'm working on with. I have one where I'm working with a payer, with a pharma company, with a startup analytics company, and several providers of several stripes to put together a specialty care medical home that will address a particular clinical condition. And just one comment on the pharma piece, because I think, you know, for years, pharma has knocked on my door, and I'm sure others, to say, how can we get in on this value-based movement? And, you know, there have been some models that will bring pharma in and create some accountability by saying, if your drug's not as efficacious as you say it is, you'll pay money back. And to me, that's sort of value-based-ish, right? It's value-based-ish because it makes them accountable for their portion. It's only ish because, in my view, it still keeps them focused only on the care that they themselves render. And for me, the big difference in fee-for-service and value is in fee-for-service, the focus is only on, it is on all of the care that's rendered by one provider. In value-based care models, we're looking at team-based collaborative approach, and we're looking at all the care that's rendered to one individual patient across the full continuum. So the way that I like to bring pharma in and that I'm testing is to bring them in. You know, my whole, well, the company is called Be Collaborative, right? And it's, I think, you know, to me, that is at the heart of the success of all of these models. And it means, in my view, that we bring various stakeholders together, allow them to talk to each other, listen to each other, understand what expertise does each have and how do we leverage it. And the pharma companies have information that could be very useful. You know, I hear docs say to me all the time, particularly docs who take care of patients with chronic conditions, they'll say to me, Lily, I cannot take accountability. How can I take accountability for this? My patients don't do what I tell them to do. They don't take their medicine. They don't follow the protocol. And I tell them, you know, one of our goal really is to be able to build models that are clinically meaningful, that can be administered, and that address, that support individuals' ability to actually be successful in their outcomes, to be able to follow the care that the docs prescribe. And you know who understands that and studies that more than anyone is pharma, because if they understand what are the barriers to adherence to medication, that's their business. They have data. They understand in almost every case the in-depth understanding of disease state in a way that a payer does not. And yeah. that in some cases, maybe even a doctor doesn't. You know, if a neurologist, for example, is treating, general neurologist is treating MS patients as part of their practice. Well, you know, there are something like 18 disease modifying therapies approved for MS. And, you know, it's very difficult for anyone to have all the knowledge about everything. And so really love this notion of bringing in different parties.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.